Sustainable Lens, Resilience on Radio. Hear an informed, intelligent, and provocative discussion of issues every week as seen through the lens of sustainability. It is brought to you by Otago Polytechnic, where all students learn how to make their industries more sustainable. It is hosted by Samuel Mann and Shane Gallagher, and joined every week by a leading figure in the sustainability scene. Sustainable Lens, Resilience on Radio, broadcast every week on Otago Access Radio, and podcast on sustainablelens.org and on oar.org.nz.
Welcome to Sustainable Lens Resilience on Radio, a weekly show on sustainability topics brought to you by Otago Polytechnic. The show is co-hosted by Samuel Mann and Shane Gallagher, who's not here tonight. I'm with Professor Eric Pawson from the University of Canterbury Department of Geography. Among other things, he's the president of the Eko Aotearoa Academy, which means that he's won a National Tertiary Teaching Award, and a particular interest in environmental history, New Zealand environmental history, landscape transformation, and does lots of work in community-based research, in particular post-earthquake Christchurch. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you.
Let's start with an easy question. Where did you grow up?
Oh, in Sussex on the south coast of England. And I came to New Zealand exactly 40 years ago today, 4th of February 1976.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
What led you
to come? It was a very hot day then as well, actually.
What led you to come here?
Ah, now that's a question I haven't thought about for a while. Let's just say that the mid-1970s in the UK was not the best time to be sort of young and aspiring academic, and things were a little bit gloomy, and I had ideas about going somewhere adventurous for a few years. I decided I'd try my hand in New Zealand for 3 years. As I say, 37 years after the 3 years expired, I'm still here and loving it.
What did you want to be when you grew up?
Well, I'm not quite sure what to say to that. When I was six, probably a fireman. When I was 18, maybe a teacher. And, you know, when the time came, then what I've done for the last 40 years, which is to teach university students and to do research.
And did you start in geography?
Yes, I did an geography degree in Oxford in the early 1970s. And then I transferred to a postgraduate college, Nuffield College, which was bankrolled by the proceeds from Morris Miners. In other words, it was set up by Lord Nuffield to train social scientists. And I switched, well, I didn't really switch, but I became as much of an economic historian as I was geographer through my training in Nuffield, which was for 3 years. And since arriving in New Zealand, I guess my interests have switched again and increasingly to issues that are sort of environmental in nature, because this is such a wonderful place to pursue those, and because there are so many hazardous situations and opportunities to pursue.
From that background, what did you first notice when you got here?
Well, here the very first thing I noticed, this may not be quite what you're expecting me to say, is how vast the sky was and how far away the horizon was, and how low slung, if you like, much of New Zealand suburbia is. And I think I was quite surprised that although from afar New Zealand has an image of being really quite rural, in effect it's predominantly a suburban country. And I've only ever felt that there are a couple of places in New Zealand where you get away from that feeling. So the first time I went to Wellington and saw some high buildings, which I think was at Easter in 1976, I was quite surprised. And the first time I came to Dunedin, because Dunedin has this wonderful sort of mid to late 19th century rather grand commercial architecture, and it's absolute delight to see that in recent years, various developers and the council are attempting to retrieve it. That's very, very interesting.
What was your PhD on?
Well, it was actually on the development of the turnpike road system in 18th century England. And the turnpike roads were toll roads. And I was trained by a historical geographer, a transport economist, and a very well-known economic historian. His name was Max Hartwell. And the significance of turnpike road and turnpike road investment is that it represented attempts to direct in investment, infrastructure investment, into accelerating economic growth during the Industrial Revolution. And in the 1970s, it was relatively unusual to understand the Industrial Revolution as a process of economic growth, rather than as a sort of disaggregated set of technical innovations, if you like. So I was interested in how the turnpike road system developed, which, you know, drawing on my background as a geographer, involved mapping the system, which was actually quite a challenge. It was very interesting to see the way in which that reflected the emergence of new commercial and industrial centres in the UK, but also the way in which it was actually networked reasonably quickly. And then I attempted to work on how that network made a contribution to the Industrial Revolution in the round, as it were.
We think more of the rail and canal networks, but there was significant roading as well.
Oh, very significant roading, yes. And the turnpike road network preceded the canals, which in turn preceded the railways. So I think before I did this work, the sort of key transport innovations in industrialisation were often seen as the railways and sometimes the canals and the railways. But as is the case now, a great deal of the feeder work, plus quite a bit of the long distance work, was actually carried by a road network. So what I was attempting to do was fill in some blank spaces, if you like. And the thing that was exciting about that was that it wasn't just itsy bitsy sections of road that were tolled. When I started to map this, by 1750, you actually had a nationwide network of roads which connected London with Birmingham, with Manchester, with Newcastle, with the emerging centres in South Yorkshire, with East Anglia, with the southwest of England. It was a network, in fact, which, if you looked at a road atlas today, and maybe took the motorways out, you'd still see in skeletal form quite clearly.
Are all the roads built?
Oh, they weren't. Turnpike roads weren't built. What actually happened was that local people, usually led by landed interests and commercial interests, had to apply to Parliament for a private act, and that enabled them to set up a toll gate. And the act regulated how the tolls were to be collected, at what sort of level, and then directed them to be used for the maintenance of the road. So when I say a network of toll roads, they weren't so much made as consistently improved from the rather sort of broad muddy tracks that they'd been previously. So in many cases this meant applying a layer of gravel and building this up over time. And it wasn't until McAdam, the Scottish roading engineer, came along in the latter part of the 18th century that you started to get something approximating more modern types of roading techniques. So when I refer to a turnpike road network, it's an aggregation of a whole series of local initiatives. And the thing which fascinated me was that, despite the fact that they were local initiatives. They did form a national network actually very quickly, because the first act for a turnpike road was, I think, in the 1660s, but realistically they didn't get underway until about the first decade of the 18th century. But by 1750 you've got something approximating a national network focused on London.
When people first arrived in New Zealand, the Europeans first arrived in New Zealand, we hear a lot about whether or not they were trying to create a little England, or and we talked to Peter Holland about the settlers, the early farmers, changing understandings of their environment. From a transport perspective, were they trying to, arriving at a place with no roads and no transport and being quite different to England in terms of the landscapes? We drove through the King Country over the summer. There's not much of England that is as rugged as that.
Yeah, well, it's an interesting question with respect to how did people actually get around. And they had to be extremely careful, because the rivers were an enormous hazard. And, I mean, you may well know that in the latter part of the 19th century, drowning was referred to as the New Zealand death. You came to New Zealand and died in a river if you weren't extremely careful. Which was why, at a relatively early stage, ferries were set up at main crossing points, which would be on animal droving routes, for example. And then some of the earliest sort of engineering projects involved building bridges at key points. But if we take a step back from that, an awful lot of trade and probably passenger traffic as well between the different colonies, let's say between Southland and Otago, between Otago and Canterbury, Canterbury and Nelson, was actually by sea. And so it was very considerable trade in coastal shipping, so that if you wanted to get from Dunedin to Auckland in the 1880s, probably even as late as the 1890s or 1900, then by that point you would probably have been able to have gone by train, say, from Invercargill to Dunedin to Christchurch. But then you'd have to get on a boat. And you would have got on a boat to Wellington. And then, because there was no complete trunk railway through the North Island until 1908, you would have got a boat to Nelson. And from Nelson, you would have gone to New Plymouth. And from New Plymouth, you would have come into Auckland from Manukau Harbour and Ananga. So it was quite an epic journey to get from one place to the next. It's always impressed me how people like parliamentarians and merchants who had to move around a fair bit actually managed to do it under these sorts of circumstances. They must have been very good at planning ahead and also taking account of the unexpected.
I know it's not possible to look back without being too deterministic about the approach, but I'll go ahead and ask this question anyway. If you were to start with a blank slate of New Zealand in the 1840s, do you think that it was, did the landscape, did the environment transform as you would have expected, or were there things that would surprise people?
From the perspective of 1840, or from the perspective of today?
I suppose from... Oh, I see. Okay, from the perspective of 1840, would their view of New Zealand have been what we've got now?
Well, if they are Pākehā settlers, I suspect in many cases... very much not. I mean, I spent most of the 1990s working on the New Zealand Historical Atlas. I was chair of the advisory board, and the historical Atlas was a sesquicentennial project, but rather than try to finish it by 1990, we sensibly decided to start in 1990 so that we could finish it when it was finished. I say that because there was actually an attempt to do a historical atlas for the New Zealand centennial in 1940, and I think they finally abandoned the idea in about 1953. And when we started the historical atlas in 1990, we found some of the old hand-drawn plates. They're still in the National Library. So my answer to your question about how the landscapes evolved and what folk at different times might have expected is informed very much by that experience of working with a large team of geographers and historians and archaeologists and Maori scholars who were involved in the historical atlas through to when we completed it in 1997. I mean, if you look at a very simple map of Pākehā settlement, say in the 1850s or the 1860s, you've got a series of what you might call bridgeheads, which are the colonies in Southland, Otago, Canterbury, the places we mentioned before, Taranaki, Nelson, Hawke's Bay. And I think the expectation was that settlement would sort of penetrate inland from these points. But of course it was considerably easier for that dream, if you like, to be attained in some places rather than in others, because I suspect the sort of social geography that was in the settler imagination didn't take account of the fact that there were large numbers of other people here before them, that they simply didn't understand the nature of iwi settlement all the way through the North Island. The fact that they didn't understand it led to the contests over territory, which culminated in the New Zealand Wars of the 1860s, which were, of course, I mean, the real flashpoints for that were the attempt to drive Pākehā agricultural settlement south from Auckland into the Waikato, and inland from Taranaki. And when those areas were eventually pacified, and that word is in quote marks, the land had been confiscated, those two areas eventually became the core of the New Zealand dairy industry around about the turn of the 20th century. If you were to go to another of these colonies, like Nelson, then Nelson, like all the others, the colonising agency had a vision on paper as to what they wanted. So many town sections, so many suburban sections, so many rural sections, and they simply wouldn't fit in the land that was available in Nelson because it's far too constrained. And one of the reasons why Nelson, despite the fact that it's actually the geographic centre of the country, and for a long time was on that transport route that I described as almost a fulcrum for traffic going north to Auckland and south around the east coast of the South Island, has never really taken off as a centre of Pākehā settlement through the 20th century, because it was far too constrained in terms of access to resources.
But Wellington itself's not much better.
Well, that's true, but Wellington, I guess, over time had a couple of advantages. One was that it overtook Nelson as a focus of longer range transport and trade routes to Sydney through the Union Steamship Company, which was headquartered, of course, in Dunedin, to Lyttelton and Port Chalmers and Bluff. And it also, from the middle of the 1860s, had all the paraphernalia of the central state. And since central government has long been the primary agency of government in this country, that gave Wellington quite a considerable advantage over smaller settlements like Napier and Nelsonham, for example, which were peripheralised in that sense.
What mistakes have been made?
Well, that's rather a large question, isn't it? I think if I think since the 1970s, collectively, we have made a considerable effort to come to grips with the fact that this is not a monocultural country. It's not simply a settler colony, but that it is a country of deeply rooted Maori heritage, which of course is expressed in quite different ways in different places. I think we've got a much greater appreciation of cultural distinctiveness and cultural difference, and the advantages of expressing that, rather than the sort of centrally driven monocultural perspective that pervaded in this country up until the 1970s, maybe for even longer. If you could perhaps count that as a mistake in quote marks. From my environmental perspective, I think you can point to a whole raft of environmental misconceptions about the settlement of this country, although I think you have to be a little bit careful about this, because, you know, as you'll know from talking to Peter Holland, it takes a while for people to apprehend the nature of a new settlement and its environment. And, you know, even today we don't have particularly good long-run environmental data in many places, so we don't know about the an enormous amount about the variability of the weather, where the extreme, how frequently extreme events might occur. We don't know too much about the hydrological behaviour of a lot of rivers. But with that proviso aside, then I think there was, if I can put it this way, quite a gung-ho attitude to settling many of the new colonies around New Zealand, which didn't take account of environmental realities, some of which emerged remarkably quickly. I mean, I think in the last few years we've had quite a focus on earthquakes in New Zealand, but the environmental hazard which potentially threatens largest losses in terms of property, at least, is flooding, because almost all New Zealand settlements are built on floodplains. Even in the late 19th century, mid to late 19th century, people were finding this out in quite unanticipated ways. So towns like Westport, for instance, which were very much at the mercy of the movement of the mouth of the Buller River, the same was absolutely true in Hokitika. You look at old maps of Hokitika and you discover that half the street plan is now in what is either sea or river mouth, because the coastline there is so unstable. 19th century Blenheim was known as Beaver Town. There were probably quite a number of other beaver towns as well, because it was very prone to floods. The Waimakariri has long been thought, up until the Canterbury earthquakes at least, to be the greatest source of environmental hazard for Canterbury, and has flooded through the middle of Christchurch since the late 1860s. Always impressed by the very deep concrete trench which encases the water of Leith as it comes through the middle of the Otago campus. I mean, what that says to me is that there are extreme events in this city that we see every few years, that people were unaware of when they settled on what they thought was good flat land in North Dunedin. So, you know, if you were to just to focus on one environmental hazard, then you could go right the way around the country identifying flood risk.
I was talking to Peter Bowler, a restoration ecologist at University of California, Irvine, last year, and we're talking about the changing perceptions of environmental features, and what we were talking about was deserts and salt marshes, both of which were previously considered wasteland, and now yes, people are starting to recognise intrinsic value. How are those perceptions changing in New Zealand?
Well, I think they've I think they've changed quite dramatically. I mean, I've done a lot of work in the last 20 years with my colleague Tom Brocking, who's professor of history at the University of Otago, and we've published a number of books on New Zealand's environmental histories, the most recent one a couple of years ago, which is called Making a New Land. And this is one of the themes that we've looked at quite explicitly. I mean, mountains, for example, which for a long time were regarded as the wastelands, the bits left over, the bits that were useless because you couldn't put sheep on them because they were just covered in rock and snow. As in many other countries overseas in the latter part of the 19th century, but increasingly through the 20th century, underwent a very positive re-evaluation, to the point where by the latter part of the 20th century, New Zealand's national park system is almost entirely centred on mountains. But one of the most interesting things which happened perhaps since the early 1980s is that the lands which have been added to the National Conservation Estate, that's in additions to national parks and new national parks and other categories of conservation land, have started to include other types of landscape that previously were evaluated in very different sorts of ways. So I remember the some of the contests over West Coast native forests not long after I arrived in the mid-70s, and it was the Muldoon government, which I think historically doesn't get much credit for this, which faced up to opposition to putting a lot of Westland native forests from the rock and the ice down to the coast into Westland National Park, so that by the mid-1980s we actually had a complete transect of landscape types and biodiversity from the alpine ridges right the way down to the coastal areas. And increasingly since that time, upland and lowland native forest has been set aside as part of the conservation estate, and to a lesser extent areas of wetland. Wetland is, I mean, in the New Zealand context, is a particularly interesting case, because the 19th century settlers identified many marshy and boggy areas as having very high potential for agricultural reclamation. So this country has one of the highest rates of reclamation of wetlands anywhere in the world, which is something which sits, you know, somewhat inconveniently with our reputation for being environmentally friendly. So that many of the coastal areas of Canterbury, for instance, is work that Peter Holland and I did years ago for the a new edition of the Natural History of Canterbury, reclaimed wetland areas. And it's only in, I think, since about the mid-1980s that we have started to revalue wetland for its intrinsic qualities, rather than for its potential as agricultural land, or worse, potential as a sewer. Now, this doesn't mean necessarily that behaviour has changed, but it does mean that the way in which we talk about these things, the way in which we think about these things, has, I think, shifted. One of the reasons for that is the nature of tribal claims to the Waitangi Tribunal since 1985, which has revealed a very rich history of Maori involvement with wetlands before the 1840s, 1850s, 1860s, and the very central role that coastal reefs and coastal lagoons and rivers played in Mahina Kai practices. Now, as I say, that doesn't necessarily mean that we're much better at looking after wetlands than we once were, but I think our aspirations for them are rather different to what they were.
And a wetland's perhaps easier to put back than the other thing that we've been particularly good at getting rid of, as forests.
Oh, well, I don't know about that. I think there are areas where it is actually possible to restore native forest, and there are a lot of experiments going on around New Zealand, many of them actually under the public radar, and these are community-based schemes for the restoration of landscapes, which doesn't necessarily mean that they'll be restored exactly as they were, because of course we've got a vegetation now across much of the country which is hybridised between native species and a lot of introductions from all around the world. But it does mean that it is possible to actually set aside areas to try to remove as many pest species from them as possible, and to, you know, get back something of the dawn chorus. One of the classic examples of this, which I have done a little bit of work on, is Banks Peninsula. I don't know enough about Otago Peninsula to know whether or not the same applies there, but large parts of Banks Peninsula are relatively damp. They have become fairly marginal farming areas. So you've tended to get two or three things happening. Small farms have been bought up by urban dwellers who've allowed forest to regenerate. There are some classic schemes in the both public and privately owned for the regeneration of native forest, of which the best known example is the Hinawai Hinawai estate. It's behind Akaro on the southeastern part of Banks Peninsula, which I think is about 1500 hectares in two separate valleys, where the ecologist Hugh Wilson for the last 30 years has been running a giant experiment. The land is owned by a private trust, and he has demonstrated that if you get rid of the pests, if you stop spraying, and if you just allow the gorse to grow freely, then within 7 to 10 years a lot of native species are growing up through the gorse, because native shrubs and native trees will germinate in that sort of shady environment underneath the thick gorse, and then they grow through the gorse and form a canopy above it, and the gorse, which needs light to flourish, dies off relatively rapidly underneath it. So you've got two whole valleys here of regenerating native bush. And within 30 years, you know, he's demonstrated that it is possible in the right conditions. Now, the right conditions would be, you know, areas where there was an available seed bank and where there was sufficient moisture. So this isn't going to happen everywhere. But there are a lot of these sort of community-based schemes, and a lot of small reserves that are owned by councils. For instance, the Christchurch City Council has equivalent small areas dotted over Banks Peninsula, where these sorts of activities are going on. I believe there are several hundred of these sorts of schemes around New Zealand. So yes, it is feasible. And the extent to which it is feasible on any scale, and the extent to which it would be possible to sort of join these things up, I don't know. But it's maybe an exciting
prospect. That's
probably
a big challenge, isn't it? That joined up thinking of
yes.
creating networks of things. You said New Zealand has a reputation for being environmentally friendly, and ignoring the hyperbole around whether about 100% pure, which is we know it can't possibly be 100% pure. But does New Zealand deserve that reputation?
Well, in some respects, I think very definitely yes. I think the big issue is how much care we actually take of the reputation, because when you have a reputation and you put it out there, as this country does through its global advertising, and that's global advertising through tourism interests, dairy companies, and what have you, then I think you have to be very careful to make sure that you're not caught out. But I don't think there are too many countries where there is such a substantial proportion of the land area that is set aside as conservation estate, which is something over a third of New Zealand, where there are perhaps quite as many attempts to restore elements of landscape, as we were talking about before. And there are many countries, of course, particularly where New Zealand's international tourists come from, in Eastern Asia and in Europe, that are far, far more densely populated and have a whole range of environmental problems that, on a gross scale at least, we don't have. Meaning, outside Auckland, we don't have too many problems with traffic jams, and outside a number of days of the year in localised areas, we don't have too many problems with air pollution. I mean, I'm well aware that we do have some of these issues in a localised sort of way, but they're not generic and characteristic as they are in some of the countries overseas from which we source many of our tourists. Having said that, I think we have to be extraordinarily careful, and you know, potentially there are a number of flashpoints that can very easily unstitch reputations like this. And you know, one of them is water quality. It's water quality on beaches. We don't have a particularly proud history in the disposal of industrial and human waste, for example. I think things have considerably improved in the last 20 or 30 years, but I think some tourists might find it a bit disconcerting to see warning notices on beaches, and I'll probably be very disappointed with water quality of lowland and some high country streams as well, particularly with problems with Didymo.
I suppose my question is New Zealand inherently better, or is it just an advantage of lower population density?
Oh, I don't think I would claim that we're inherently better. I think it's a function of the fact that a very large proportion of the country is mountainous and is therefore sort of off limits for development, and the fact that our population is low and population density is relatively low. I mean, somebody I think is going to say straight away, well, you know, even in the mountainous areas you've got possums and deer and all of this sort of thing, and that's been true since the 1880s. I can remember reading a book on Mr. Explorer Douglas, who was an Otago explorer who spent much of his time going through South Westland and Fiordland in the 1880s and the 1890s, and he was observing the presence of wild cats there, you know, even then. So you know, I don't think we must exaggerate our virtues, but on the other hand, I think we are reasonably fortunate by virtue of our situation, but also that we have to work pretty hard to maintain any sort of reputation based on that.
Okay, so let's go to a situation that's not reasonably fortunate. Post-earthquake Christchurch. What have you been doing there?
Well, I mean, I teach in a university which has been very severely affected by the earthquakes. I was in the University of Canterbury Staff Club with some visitors from the University of Bristol. It was their first day in New Zealand when the February earthquake struck in 2011, and plaster off the wall started landing in our drinks, and everybody got under the table. We were actually upstairs. There was a party downstairs who were terrified that the upstairs was going to land on top of them. And I can remember, as I was half under the table, looking out of the window at the wonderful old trees that surround the Islam Homestead, which is our staff club, which were swaying with the earthquake tremors through 90 degrees. It was absolutely extraordinary to see the movement of these trees. And subsequently, everybody in Christchurch became very well used to continuous tremors arriving at quite, you know, catching you unawares at unexpected times. And I mean, one of the things which intrigued me is the very different ways in which different types of tremor express themselves. And after a while, I could actually hear them coming a second or two beforehand. It sounded like there was a sort of train coming down the street. And some of them would hit with a great thud, and some of them would be rather like bouncing up and down on a bed. And sometimes you would look at the walls of the house, and that would be bouncing in and out rather like this. Every earthquake wave appeared to have a slightly distinctive sort of signature, which was the sort of thing you became aware of as it went on and on and on, because from September 2010 through to about the end of 2013, which is about when things, you know, really settled down. We still get a few tremors now, but they're not really anything very much. But there were about 12,000 shakes over that period, which is an awful lot, and rather more than might be sort of realistically expected from one or two large events. But the reason I think that these we know the reason why these earthquakes were so damaging is that they were very shallow, they were relatively powerful, and they, many of them were right under the city, and that is what did for Christchurch, which sort of sits in a bowl of gravel, and that gravel liquefied during the major events, and a lot of fine watery silt was forced to the surface under great pressure, and that's what destroyed the foundations of many of the tall buildings in the city centre. It's what made much of the land in the eastern part of the city, but also in some western parts of the city adjacent to streams, quite unusable, and it's what destroyed the foundations of many houses and bent and buckled them. And our campus has been quite severely affected, and we're perhaps halfway through a sort of renovation and reconstruction process at present. My own department has been in and out of its building, I think, three times so far, and we face at least one, if not two more moves. But the opportunity for education that the earthquakes posed really is an answer to the question, you know, do we just carry on as normal because people expected a little bit of normality in a very unusual sort of situation, or could we actually do something quite different? And certainly what we've done in geography at Canterbury is that we've taken several of our courses out into the community, which is what I call sort of working in classrooms without borders, and we work with community agencies and community groups with groups of students on research topics that are of need in post-earthquake Christchurch. And we do this actually through our curriculum, but the core area in which we do it is with a capstone course, which means a course that we would like everybody to do at 300 level, which has a very boring generic title. It's just called Research Methods in Geography, because we've never been able to think of anything much better. But the title doesn't seem to put people off, and we still get between about 50 and 75 students each year, which is as many as we can manage. And with my colleague Simon Kingham, we spend a certain amount of the year negotiating potential areas of research with community groups and community agencies, so that when the course starts at the beginning of the second semester, students can nominate the topics in which they're interested, and we then sort them into groups of five. So if we have a class of 75, we need 15 topics, and that probably means working with 10 agencies. And when you don't have any help to do this, that's actually, you know, quite sufficient workload. But it is actually very rewarding, because what we do is take the students off campus on the second weekend of the semester for them to get to know each other, because many of them won't have met the other people in their group of five previously, and they get to meet us, and they also get to meet their community partner. And we work with a range of community partners, for instance Project Littleton, which is a transition towns group in the port town of Littleton. We've worked with Trees for Canterbury, which is a long established social enterprise which has a native tree nursery and planting programs. We work with the Avonatakaro Network, which is an umbrella organization which looks after community interests in the red zone, which is a huge area that stretches from the city centre in Christchurch right down to the coast at New Brighton along the Avon River, where the Crown has brought out 7,000 households, and the land is managed by well, I think a combination of the Canterbury Earthquake Recovery Authority and LINS. At present it's largely empty, although a fair number of trees and shrubs have been left there. It represents a huge potential for sort of future community uses, and our students have done a lot of work since 2012 on articulating what those sorts of uses might be. We also work with residents' associations. We have worked with schools. There's a whole number of different agencies that we work with. And the purpose of the first weekend is to enable the students to meet their community partner and begin to formulate a research program around a particular focus. So they have to identify the focus, then they have to identify a question, which might sound easy, but in fact is often the hardest part of doing research, and then work out a program. Now, each group has a staff or PhD tutor to assist them, but essentially we wind them up and then let them go for the rest of the semester.
How do you work with them and the community to make sure that you don't end up with the community being studied upon? You want it to have some real impact for the community.
Yes, very good point. And I don't think we'd be at all keen to work in circumstances like that. Many of these community agencies and groups come to us, and when I said that we negotiate topics with them, I mean, broadly speaking, we will negotiate an area of interest, and then the community partner will actually work with the students to draw the contours of what they're interested in a bit more clearly. And the students are expected to work with the community partner right the way through the semester, so that it is actually a partnership research process. Now, the pedagogical purpose of this is both to encourage students to understand how a process of research works, and to draw upon the different skills that you get in a group of five advanced students by 300 level to undertake that research process. But it's also to encourage them to discover how to work with each other and to discover how to work with people outside the university setting. I mean, the thing that we regard as absolutely critical these days for a whole variety of reasons is that students are able to work not just as individuals but in collective and collaborative situations. And that's one of our motivations for this type of sort of pedagogical approach.
Okay, some questions to end with, because we're running out of time. What's the biggest success you've had in the last couple of years?
Well, I would say it has to do with exactly what I've just been talking about. For instance, our students have carried out a whole series of projects in the residential red zone. There was one project they did on its potential as a recreational corridor, in which they used some GIS mapping techniques to draw up a sort of best fit cycling route, which has been subsequently adopted by the city council as part of its citywide cycleways strategy. We've done a lot of work on flooding and the potential for the development of wetlands within the red zone to alleviate flooding issues, but also to work out what community aspirations are for the red zone and how those might be accommodated around sort of landscape transformations over time. There's one particular lake in the residential red zone which is owned by the city council. It's not crown land, so a lot of our work has been focused on that. And so physical geographers have done a lot of hydrological work on that, and the human geographers have done a lot of work with local schools on adopting the lake as a series of outdoor classrooms, or using the lakeshore as a series of outdoor classrooms. And this sort of thing is very exciting. And we run a public conference at the end of this course, and the community partners will turn up to that, and it's very satisfying to see what they get out of it and how students react to this sort of thing. Now, it's not for everybody, of course, but you'll get many students who really light up in a process like this and say, you know, when I started this course, I wasn't sure that I wanted to work with anybody else, and I hate public speaking, but now I love public speaking, and I've discovered it's great fun working with other people. That, I would say, is the most rewarding thing I've done in the last couple of years.
What motivates you?
Well, I think I've just indicated one of the things which motivates me, which is working with other people on things that are rewarding and have some intrinsic value and some sort of wider purpose, and are about, you know, rather more than sort of information transmission. I don't believe in an information transmission model of education. I hope that's reasonably clear by now. I think that education is something that people create for themselves with a certain amount of assistance and a considerable amount of guidance, but it's a process of guided self-discovery, if you like. And I mean, one of my key motivations is working in that sort of way with students and other folk.
Do you consider yourself to be an activist?
Well, I guess it depends what you mean by an activist. As an environmental activist in the conventional sense of the word, no. An educational activist in the senses that I've been describing, which is perhaps less putting myself forward and more encouraging other people to find out how they can best act in the world. If that's a definition of activist, then yes, but it's probably not the conventional definition.
What challenges have you got in the next couple of years that you're looking forward to?
Well, actually, I'm going to retire at the end of the year. So, and one of the reasons for that is because there are so many exciting things to do and there are so many exciting places to go that I'm fairly determined to get onto them whilst, you know, whilst I have time and energy. And I like to travel. I have friends in a number of countries overseas. I love, I've just come back from Denmark, in fact, and northern Germany. I love exploring other landscapes with friends. I will carry on with some of the community-based teaching that I've been describing to you, because that's what sort of particularly motivates me in a teaching context at present. And I'm sure there are lots of other things. As anybody who's sort of at my stage of life will say, there are all those books I want to read.
And to write, probably.
Oh, one or two, yes.
If you could wave a magic wand and have a miracle occur, what would it be?
Well, it's a very interesting question. I'm not actually sure that I believe in miracles, which is possibly why I've not ever sort of thought of the question in
we'll ask a slightly different question. What's the smallest thing that we could do that would make the biggest amount of difference
in terms of the sorts of things that we're thinking about? This is sort of slightly it's not tangential, but it's slightly different to some of the things we're talking about, but it is related to them. There are an awful lot of people in my home city at the moment who are still in very, very difficult situations with insurance companies and with unmended homes, and it strikes many of us who are more fortunate and are in actually, you know, places that have been fixed or didn't really need much fixing. It's a travesty that after 5 years we haven't been able to take care of everybody, and I think we ought to be able to wave a collective wand and fix this. It really should not be beyond our sort of collective and political abilities to sort that sort of thing out. I really don't think that's good enough.
And lastly, do you have any advice for our listeners?
I don't know that I deal in advice. You're asking me questions that are not the sort of questions that I normally think of. So I don't think I want to. I don't think I want to give advice. It's not the sort of thing that that I do.
All right. Thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you very much.
Sustainable Lens, Resilience on Radio.
You've been listening to Sustainable Lens, Resilience on Radio, a weekly show on sustainability topics brought to you by Otago Polytechnic. The show is co-hosted by Shane Gallagher and me, Samuel Mann. We broadcast on Otago Access Radio, oar.org.nz, and podcast on sustainablelens.org. On sustainablelens.org, we're building up a searchable archive of conversations with people from many different fields who are applying their skills to a sustainable future. In our conversations, we try to find out what motivates them and what it means to see the world through a sustainable perspective, through their sustainable lens. Tonight's Sustainable Lens was that of Professor Eric Pawson from the University of Canterbury Geography. We recorded that at the New Zealand Geographical Society conference at Otago University. You can follow the links on sustainablelens.org to find us on Facebook, and you can find Sustainable Lens in all the usual poddy places for free. That was Sustainable Lens. I'm Samuel Mann. I hope you enjoyed the show.